And welcome to this particular part in the show. This is where we like to look at a book or some alternate history literature and find out more about it, really, and find out more about the author behind it. And one of my favourite reads at the moment is a book called Atomic Secrets. I've been reading over the past couple of weeks or so, and I'm delighted to say that the author of that book joins me now, John Hopkins. Hello, John.
Good afternoon, Ben. How are you?
I'm not too bad. More importantly, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Yeah, looking forward to this chat.
First of all, tell us how you got started in alternate history. I suppose I should ask, actually, were you a writer before you were interested in AH as well?
How I got interested in alternate history was more to do with an interest in the Second World War.
All right.
Super interested in aircraft especially. So I got interested in that. And I think I probably stumbled across the alternatehistory.com website when I was just looking up planes and things. I had read Fatherland not long after it came out.
It's a borderline rite of passage, I think, isn't it?
Particularly aware of it as alternate history as a genre. It's a very good book, actually. I reread it a couple of years ago.
So have you written anything before you embarked on Atomic Secrets, and what made you want to do it?
I've always been a reader. From back when I was a little kid, I was reading stuff, you know, normally something with bears on it or something like that. Then I started getting into detective stories as a kid. As I sort of got older and stuff, I sort of moved into it. And when I moved down to London for work, I started writing back then, which was more years ago than I care to mention. But I never really got anywhere with it until maybe 4 years ago or so. I think probably during the pandemic, as a lot of people did, I had a lot of starts, but I'd never finished anything. I actually self-published another non-alternate history novel back then. But because of my interest in alternate history, I had a lot of thoughts around that as well. So once I finished with that, I decided to jump into what became Atomic Secrets.
It is interesting you mentioned detective work, and you're interested in that from an early age, because of course there is an element of it in Atomic Secrets, which we'll come on to in a couple of minutes' time. First of all, I want to know how the association with Sea Lion Press came about. How did you get in contact with Tom and Alex and co?
So that was through the alternatehistory.com website initially. So I saw, you know, some of their posts. They've got their thread around sort of their publications. I'd read the Anglo-American Nazi War, the famous thread that turned into a book there. So I sort of was aware of them and looked on their forums as well as alternatehistory.com. And then once I'd written the book, I just reached out to find out if they were interested, given that they were specifically an alternate history publisher rather than a more generic publisher. I thought there would perhaps be more interest in an independent writer. Luckily for me, there was.
What's that been like, knowing that you've actually got a published novel out there?
It's pretty cool. I'd self-published before, but actually having a proper publisher, someone to actually, you know, design the cover for me, someone else to proofread it and find all of my dreadful spelling and punctuation. I don't use social media, but I did post on LinkedIn and when it got published, and quite a few people were quite surprised that I was doing this sort of in my spare time and that.
Tell us about the book itself. Tell us more about Atomic Secrets. Tell us about the premise, I suppose, we should start.
It's set in the well sort of trodden path of a different outcome to Second World War. The Germans didn't lose, I'll say. I would hesitate to say that they won, but they didn't lose. So a Nazi regime survives. Jump forward to the late 40s, and the first chapter is around a test of a UK bomb. And then we move into concerns about a potential German atomic program, and the story goes on from that. So we've got, in effect, a secret agent type who is looking in to find out a little bit more about that.
There were obviously concerns about the Soviet atomic program in what we'd call real life, but of course the idea of the Nazis having the atomic bomb sort of got amplified, didn't it, really?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think with hindsight, you know, everyone is pretty confident that that was so far away, because just the dysfunctional nature of the regime, and there were so many different people trying to move along with the program. But, you know, the famous letters to Roosevelt in the late 30s or the early 40s about a need to develop an atomic bomb, which obviously led to the Manhattan Project in real life, suggested that the Germans would get it. And if we look back at history, there were a lot of German physicists who were involved in some of that early sort of investigations and in research. People like Otto Hahn and the like, and, you know, fission was first performed, I think, in Germany as well. So they had a lot of that sort of knowledge there. And I guess fortunately for the real world, a lot of that knowledge was chased away by the regime and their sort of dislike of so-called Jewish science, which hampered their program probably a little bit more as well. But I think in reality, the vast resources that the Western allies were able to put into the Manhattan Project couldn't really have been duplicated in Germany anyway, so they would have taken an awful lot longer to come up with a bomb anyway, I think, and we're in the late 40s in Atomic Secrets, and they're still not close, if we're honest.
They're closer than the Allied powers, or the UK, predominantly, would like them to be, is basically where we're at. You did say you were a bit wary of the idea of doing a post-World War II timeline, but I think you managed to avoid the clichés. Was that something that you were constantly on edge about throughout the writing of the book?
I was very conscious about not doing too much of the obvious Nazi tropes around sort of owning the world, ruling the world, bases on the moon, etc. I wanted to try and keep it slightly more realistic, and especially not to focus too much on how they'd won. It was more to do with the aftermath.
We'll talk more about the situation regarding the powers of the world now, actually, because it seems that you've created something of a multipolar instead of bipolar world. Was that your ambition? Was that your aim when you set out with the story?
Yeah, I think to an extent, the US is still obviously going to be vastly powerful just because of their capabilities and the size of the country and their economic heft. With the war being significantly shorter, Britain didn't get into quite as much debt, but the Americans didn't get involved in the European war. So the British were very much sort of still on their own, although, as I say, I've glossed over quite a lot of that. So their military continued to build up and continues to do so up to the present day, as it were, in the story. And then obviously Germany is the vast power in Europe, controlling most of the continent, either through relationships or actual occupation. Italy still exists as a power, still pretty close to Germany, but a bit more independent maybe than they were towards the end of their involvement in World War II. And then, although it's not mentioned particularly, the Soviet Union still exists to an extent, but very much reduced compared to the real world.
It is noted that the USSR exists to a degree with covert assistance from Britain and the US at various levels. The relationship, obviously, between the UK and the US isn't what it was after World War II as we knew it. I get the impression that it was sort of a continuation of what it was post-World War I, with the addition of the suspicion of the Nazi regime, I suppose.
Exactly that. We're not as close. It wasn't a vast incoming US population that sort of crowded Britain in the 40s as well. Britain, in the end, largely were alone in the fight against Germany. And because obviously you don't have the Soviet allies as well in this case, the German-American relationship is probably slightly better than it would have been in the real world as well. So there is that sort of tension between the US and the UK in that area.
You've got Henry Wallace as president at some point, I think, in your timeline, in your story.
Yes.
Tell us a bit more about the characters and how the story develops without giving too many spoilers away, please.
The lead is David Brooke. He's a secret agent, in effect. Where you grew up on the Bond films and the Bond books. I've read, you know, all the original books when I was probably a little bit too young to read them, if I'm honest. So I tried to develop him as just a guy who drifted into this. He did fly during the war as well, so what this war's Battle of Britain would have been. He was a pilot in the 30s with his father, so when that happened, he became a pilot, left the service due to a crash and an injury, and then moved into the intelligence world. The other main protagonist, and I'll be careful what I say here, is someone who is in the German program. They are reticent, shall we say, about what the work they're doing involves. They are aware that there can only be one outcome, and they are not convinced that that outcome is correct. And there are some other issues around that character as to what their motivations are as well. And then the other sort of key area is a German police force. So there's a few people in the German police force that start to get involved around halfway through and sort of try to extend slightly the sort of standard Nazi stereotypes without making them too sympathetic.
One of the protagonists was actually a woman, as was one of the police officers. one of the senior police officers. Was there any particular reason for that?
Partly it was just something a little bit different, certainly for one of them. Part of our thinking was because of the situation in the East with the occupation of the former Soviet Union, a lot of able-bodied men are still in service. And there was a need to allow women to do more. I know that there was a couple of comments on that. I had a few sort of test reads of it about whether that was likely in the Nazi regime. And I just thought, well, maybe needs must in this case. You know, it's several years after the end of the formal war, but they are still fighting and still losing lots of people in the East. And they just needed people. And they decided they would utilize women in a bit more of a enlightened way than maybe they would have. But yeah, I just felt that that was a way to bring in slightly more diverse character set.
Yeah, it did sort of signal the real politique, in a way, of the Nazi regime, at least until the late 40s, from the end of the war, so to speak, in the sense that they were employing women when they probably, at least the original Nazi regime, wouldn't have wanted to.
And one of the things I did mention as well is the big pressure to have big families, and that police officer still does have children, but yes, maybe not as many as is expected and stuff. They should be at home having the babies type thing is very much an expectation, but I've sort of allowed her to maybe just step away from that a tiny bit.
Well, it's interesting as well, because another police officer has six children, which most of us would consider a fair amount, but I guess is almost what the Reich would like people to do in this scenario, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, as I said, you know, they're short people and they're desperately trying to populate millions of square kilometres of the country they've invaded and trying to subjugate many people. And the original plan for the thousand-year Reich would have needed lots and lots of people to fill that land. So there is a lot of pressure. But yeah, the poor guy with the six kids and being told he needs more is interesting.
And did you think about what the rest of the world would have been like in this scenario? India and the like, of course, being in the orbit, presumably still of the British Empire at this point, and other parts of the world such as... As well, you did mention the Ukraine, actually.
That's where they've really tried to focus their expansions, because they want the grain and things from the Ukraine, sort of bread basket, and then going down into the Caucasus as well to try and get the oil, which they're still very keen to get. Those two bits there, I think a lot of what would be the Western Russia is still a pretty awful place to be for anyone. In terms of the rest of the world, I've tried to not be too specific on what's happening in some of the other parts of the world, because I want to sort of leave my options open for the future. As you mentioned, India is still within the British sphere of influence. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure where I'm going with that yet. I'm thinking about where that might go. Similarly with the Middle East, there's a few changes in the Middle East.
I mean, I don't remember you saying what specifically happened to the likes of India. I'm just guessing that with Nazi Germany still a going concern, a lot of the places that were decolonizing in real life would probably want to stay within the orbit of the British Empire in this scenario.
Yeah, I think that's likely. I didn't mention India, certainly, in this book, but I think that is a likely outcome. I'm in the middle of, well, I finished the next one, actually, and there is a mention of the Middle East, and one country in the Middle East sort of tries to get in bed with the Nazis, and it doesn't work out that well for them, shall we say. There is a certain desire to keep that protective arm on, as the Nazis are still a nation of conquest at the moment. The Soviet Union still takes up most of their time, but they're not averse to trying to make trouble elsewhere as well, in the same way perhaps that the Soviets took that role in the Cold War, proxy wars with the US and things like that.
And you do get the feeling as well, actually, that Germany in this scenario is almost akin to Russia in the present day, in the sense that it's isolated, it's very difficult to get out.
They've probably got maybe more friends than the Soviets have, well, the Russians have today, but it is a very, very closed society. There's not really a lot of freedom in Europe. France is maybe slightly freer. The Germany itself, because of their size as well, some of the rest of the world do sort of like get forced almost into sort of working with them, just because, you know, in the same way again as the former Soviet Union used to do with countries that just couldn't afford to fight them.
Well, the argument before the war that we need to work with Nazi Germany, which sort of led to appeasement, I get the feeling that's still very much a concern.
100%. The fact that the communist sort of system has lost to the fascist system means that that there's perhaps more fascist supporters in the UK and the US than there were after the real war. But then we had some communist supporters in real life. And I think that those sort of things are flipped, and it's more to do with, you know, following the victor rather than anything else.
You alluded to it, actually, that the British Union of Fascists were still a going concern at that point. And of course, yeah, over in the US, there was actually still some sort of Red Scare.
Not as much as in real life, but there was, yeah, there is still a dislike of communism, even though it's not exactly in a great state. But there's probably still a bit of a fascist scare as well over there, because it hasn't been denounced and destroyed in the way that it was in real life.
Moving on to the sort of points of departure, if you like, that caused the situation to be as it was in the late 40s. You did say earlier on that you didn't want to touch too much on them, and you actually didn't mention one of the big points of departure or signal when it was going to be, when it happened, until near to the end of the book. Was that an attempt in some ways to avoid what Turtle Dove calls the as you know Bob syndrome, where characters are sort of, in some alternate histories, are going, as you know, such and such happened, that sort of pitfall, I suppose.
Partly that, but also because I wanted the focus to more be around sort of like what this character was doing rather than what had happened in the past. So there was a few oblique references to the fact that the war ended significantly earlier than it did, and it ended in a different way. Similarly, in the future, there'll be like those oblique references as well, which things that haven't been covered, to sort of flesh out a little bit more, possibly a little bit of covering some of the stuff we talked about earlier on about other countries and where they've aligned themselves. But yeah, I just wanted to try and make it more around this character rather than what is in effect sort of 6-7 years before.
It's interesting. You didn't allude to what happened to Churchill in this timeline, but I do wonder, can you tell us, or is that too much of a spoiler perhaps for the next instalment, so to speak?
I've not decided entirely. He isn't the Prime Minister when the war ends, is what I'll say.
I got the feeling that he wasn't Prime Minister at all, because he was actually briefly referred to by David Brooke in terms of his writing on atomic energy. So I get the feeling he was perhaps more known, or at least as well known, for his writing as for his politics at that point.
That's an interesting inference, actually. I hadn't thought that that would be inferred. It's interesting you picked that up as well, that he was mentioned very briefly.
What can we expect from the sequel?
I'm actually in the process of editing, and then I'm going to send it off to my test reader. So it's tentatively titled Funny Money. It is about counterfeit money. It's set in Egypt, largely. There's an additional sort of like plot line that I won't mention, because that would probably be a bit of a spoiler, but most of the story takes place in Egypt around counterfeit money and attempts to sort of destabilize Egypt, which is a key part of Britain's strategy, obviously with the Suez Canal and things like that. So yes, that's currently being edited at the moment.
When can we expect that to be released, do you think?
I would hope sometime sort of like later this year, if Sea Lion are interested and we can fit in with their schedule.
John, how do people keep up to date with all things John Hopkins and what you're up to and the release of the sequel? How do people go about that?
As I mentioned earlier, I'm not on social media for a number of reasons, but then contact me. My email address is jahopkins.author@gmail.com. So if they're interested in sort of following up there, they're most welcome to do so. That email address is also in the back of the book. I tend to be on Alternate History website quite a lot. Most days I'll have a glance. Yeah. I post under the name Horton229, which goes back to my like of planes, even if that one doesn't really exist. Early sort of like chapters of Atomic Secrets was certainly put up on there on the writers forum. Once I'm satisfied that I've got a lot of the next one ready, then I'll probably put a few chapters up there for comment and feedback again, because that was really useful and I got some really helpful insights from the people on the site there.
And of course, if people want to get hold of Atomic Secrets in all its glory, which I suggest that they do myself, how do people do that?
So at the moment it's only on Kindle, so you can get it on Kindle through Amazon. There's some conversations going on around a possible paperback issue later in the year. I know the Sea Lion people are pretty busy with getting some current stable up and running on paperback, so hopefully there'll be an option for that later in the year.